the new commandment. Now, Jesus spent his last night as a human in the company of his disciples, observing the Passover and giving his parting thoughts and instructions to them, although they did not know it was his last night, not at that point. He had washed his disciples' feet to impress upon them the lessons of humility and service to one another, lessons that he had previously tried to communicate repeatedly with words. Now he was trying to teach those lessons through his actions. He also told them many things that he wanted them to remember. And I remember a discourse by Brother Tim Krupa a number of years ago. It had to do with organization of messages, kind of like today, but it was a different thing. And he talked about research showing that an audience was most likely to remember what a speaker said in the last 3 to 5 minutes, something like that, or the first 3 to 5 minutes and the last 3 to 5 minutes. And therefore, a good speaker structures his presentation with that in mind. Hopefully, I remembered that as we get to the end. And so he said that the speaker would reiterate or summarize in the last few minutes the important points of the message that he or she wanted the audience to remember. Well, these were the last hours that Jesus would be together with his disciples. He told them the most important things he wanted them to remember. Jesus said that one of them would betray him, and there was disbelief among them. He said that it would be one to whom he gives a piece of bread dipped in the dish of wine or broth or sauce. And he dipped the piece of bread and gave it to Judas, and he went out. Then Jesus said, and this is in John, the 13th chapter, verse 33, "My little children, I will be with you only a little longer. You will look for me, and just as I told the Jews, so I tell you now. Where I am going, you cannot come." You know, as I was looking at that verse, I thought it was interesting that he said, "What I told the Jews," and all the disciples, of course, were Jews. And as I looked in the commentaries, it was, I'll share with you a comment from Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown. It says a remarkable word here that he uses, referring to the people as the Jews, because the 11 were all themselves Jews. But now that he and they were on a higher footing, he leaves the name to those who were Jews and nothing but Jews. And it was after this that Jesus gave some of his deeper lessons. And the very first one was a new commandment. And we read that in the 34th and the 35th verses of John 13. I'm reading primarily from the NIV translation tonight. And this is what it says. "A new command I give you, love one another. As I have loved you, so you must love one another. By this all men will know that you are my disciples, if you love one another." And all of those words are agape or agapeo. And a while later, still talking with his disciples, he repeated this in the 15th chapter, verses 12 to 14. And we'll read that. "My command is this, love each other as I have loved you. Greater love has no one than this, that he lay down his life for his friends. You are my friends if you do what I command." Well, we might ask, how was loving one another a new commandment? Wasn't loving one another directly taught by God through the law and the prophets in the Old Testament? Well, yes. In Leviticus, the 19th chapter, we're going to read verses 16 to 18. Leviticus 19, 16 to 18. Do not go about spreading slander among your people. Do not do anything that endangers your neighbor's life. I am the Lord. Do not hate your brother in your heart. Rebuke your neighbor frankly, so you will not share in his guilt. Do not seek revenge or bear a grudge against one of your people, but love your neighbor as yourself. I am the Lord. So, loving your neighbor as yourself was already taught in the Old Testament. By the time of Jesus, and actually long before, this commandment had become corrupted. Here is what he said during his Sermon on the Mount, which we heard today was approximately in the middle of his ministry. Matthew 5, verses 43 through 48. Matthew 5, 43 through 48. You have heard that it was said, love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I tell you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, that you may be sons of your Father in heaven. He causes his sun to rise on the evil and the good, and sends rain on the righteous and the unrighteous. If you love those who love you, what reward will you get? Are not even the tax collectors doing that? And if you greet only your brothers, what are you doing more than they? Do not even pagans do that? Be perfect, therefore, as your heavenly Father is perfect. Now, maybe this corruption of love your neighbor and hate your enemy had been rationalized as justified by other scriptures in the Old Testament. For instance, if we read in Deuteronomy, the 23rd chapter, the first six verses, Deuteronomy 23, 1 through 6, I'm reading from today's English version of those verses. Actually, I'm going to start with verse, I'm just going to read verse 6. It's talking about other nations round about. And verse 6 says, as long as you are a nation, never do anything to help those nations or to make them prosperous. Well, and then in Psalm 139, a psalm of David, I'm going to read verses 19 through 24. 19 through 24 of Psalm 139. If only you would slay the wicked, O God. Away from me, you bloodthirsty men. They speak of you with evil intent. Your adversaries misuse your name. Do I not hate those who hate you, O Lord, and abhor those who rise up against you? I have nothing but hatred for them. I count them my enemies. Search me, O God, and know my heart. Test me and know my anxious thoughts. See if there is any offensive way in me, and lead me in the way everlasting. So maybe from passages like that, from David and from Deuteronomy, there might have been this rationalization, well, it's okay to hate the wicked, hate their enemies. And so the command to love your neighbor as yourself from the Old Testament had become corrupted. We also know that love your neighbor as yourself was part of the Old Testament law by the answer that an expert in the law, a scribe or a Pharisee, gave to Jesus as recorded in Luke, the 10th chapter. And we're going to start by reading verses 25 through 29 of Luke 10. On one occasion, an expert in the law stood up to test Jesus. Teacher, he asked, what must I do to inherit eternal life? And Jesus replied by saying, what is written in the law? How do you read it? He answered, love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your strength and with all your mind, and love your neighbor as yourself. Jesus replied, you have answered correctly. Do this and you will live. But he, that is the expert in the law, wanted to justify himself, so he asked Jesus, and who is my neighbor? And then Jesus told the parable. And we'll take the time to read it. The parable of the Good Samaritan. Jesus answered him by saying, a man was going down from Jerusalem to Jericho when he fell into the hands of robbers. They stripped him of his clothes, beat him, and went away, leaving him half dead. A priest happened to be going down the same road. And from earlier, we learned that going down was to a lower elevation, down to Jericho. Was going down the same road, and when he saw the man, he passed by on the other side. So too a Levite, when he came to the place and saw him, passed by on the other side. But a Samaritan, as he traveled, came where the man was, and when he saw him, he took pity on him. He went to him and bandaged his wounds, pouring on oil and wine. Then he put the man on his own donkey, took him to an inn, and took care of him. The next day, he took out 2 silver coins and gave them to the innkeeper. Look after him, he said, and when I return, I will reimburse you for any extra expense you may have. Which of these 3 do you think was a neighbor to the man who fell into the hands of robbers? The expert in the law replied, the one who had mercy on him. And Jesus told him, go and do likewise. By this parable, Jesus explains that anyone in need should be treated as if they are our neighbor. So, isn't love thy neighbor as thyself the same as Jesus' new command to love one another? What was new about this? Well, let's read it again in John 13, 34 and 35. A new command I give you, love one another. As I have loved you, so you must love one another. By this, all men will know that you are my disciples, if you love one another. What is new about this? Well, I think the part that is new is, as I have loved you. As I have loved you. Not loving your neighbor as you love yourself, but as Jesus loved us. What is new is that Jesus was saying that his disciples must not simply love their neighbors as themselves, but to love their neighbors more than themselves. And Jesus was going to demonstrate that later that night and the next day. He was to the point in his life where he was teaching by action, not merely words. He needed to show by action to put these important points across to his disciples. Just as he had resorted to teaching by his actions when he washed their feet, demonstrating the lessons of humility and service, he was now going to demonstrate that he loved others more than himself, more than his own life, by dying to redeem and save them. Elsewhere, Jesus had said, and this is in Luke 6, 32 to 36, if you love those who love you, what credit is that to you? Even sinners love those who love them. And if you do good to those who are good to you, what credit is that to you? Even sinners do that. And if you lend to those from whom you expect repayment, what credit is that to you? Sinners lend to sinners, expecting to be repaid in full. But love your enemies. Do good to them, and lend to them without expecting to get anything back. Then your reward will be great, and you will be some of the most sons of the Most High. Because he is kind to the ungrateful and the wicked, be merciful just as your Father is merciful. That is a higher standard of love than had been taught before. Jesus was laying the foundation for his new commandment in that passage. He stated the same in his Sermon on the Mount, which we already read. But I tell you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, that you may be sons of your Father in heaven. If you love those who love you, what reward will you get? We have to go and look at a higher standard of love. As we said in a discourse last year, sometimes we imagine that there are limits to the love of Jesus and the love of his Father. But each one sacrificed what was most precious to them to save and redeem a completely rebellious human race. The Apostle Paul writes that the extent of the love of Jesus is beyond our comprehension. He writes in Ephesians 3, verses 16 to 19, I pray that out of his glorious riches he may strengthen you with power through his Spirit in your inner being, so that Christ may dwell in your hearts through faith. And I pray that you, being rooted and established in love, may have the power, together with all the saints, to grasp how wide and long and high and deep is the love of Christ, and to know that this love surpasses knowledge, that you may be filled to the full, to the measure of the fullness of God. Christ's love was so great that he willingly gave his life in a very painful and humiliating way. But here's what Paul says about him in Hebrews 2, verses 2 and 3. Let us fix our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of our faith, who, for the joy set before him, endured the cross, scorning the shame, and sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. Consider him who endured such opposition from sinful men, so that you will not grow weary and lose heart. Is our love so great that we would gladly give our life to save another human life? How about to save all of humanity as Jesus did? Do we love our neighbors more than ourselves? Jesus did. Besides the testimony of this standard of love demonstrated by Jesus, there are some great contemporary stories of this kind of love. There is the true story of Desmond Doss. Anybody know the name Desmond Doss? Well, his story was chronicled in the movie Hacksaw Ridge. So I'm going to summarize that for you, for those who haven't. He was a very religious Seventh-day Adventist Christian. And because of that church's teaching on nonviolence, and because of some events in his childhood and youth, Desmond never wanted anything to do with guns. But in World War II, he enlisted with the intent of becoming a medic to save lives. The Army sent him to basic training to teach him to be a combat soldier. He refused to handle guns and pleaded to be trained as a medic. He was mistreated by the training officers and fellow recruits, but to make a long story short, he was eventually allowed to be trained as a medic. At the Battle of Okinawa, his division was assigned to take control of a high escarpment that they had to climb up with ropes, ladders. And after ascending the escarpment, they came under heavy enemy fire. Many were killed and wounded, and the Americans were driven off the escarpment and retreated. At great peril to himself, Desmond did not go down, and he remained on the top all night long, all by himself, moving around stealthily, finding wounded soldiers who were still alive, treating their wounds, carrying or dragging them to the escarpment edge, and lowering each one down by a rope that burned through the gloves on his hand one by one. He said that each time he lowered one down and pulled the rope back up, he prayed to God and said, "Lord, help me find one more." He kept doing this all night long and saved the lives of 75 men. Desmond Doss loved others more than himself. Another story. In 1974, I went on a trip to Europe, Egypt, and Israel, organized by Brother Carl Hagenstick. We attended a convention in Lille, France, and then headed to Krakow, Poland, to attend 2 days of the Polish General Convention. But Carl had the dates wrong, and we arrived the day before the convention began. So we had an extra day with trying to figure out what to do with it. Options were quickly organized, and about half of us decided to go and visit Auschwitz death camp. Because we had not made any prior arrangement, there was no English-speaking guide available, only a Polish-speaking one. Ah, but we had Polish-speaking brethren. So Sister Florence Niemiecki translated the guide's messages all the time we were there. During the course of the visit, the guide told us that only a few people had ever escaped from Auschwitz. Whenever one did, the camp guards would execute 10 prisoners, either by hanging firing squad at the wall of death or by putting them in a chamber of death, a room in the basement of a building next to the wall of death that could be sealed airtight. And once the men were locked in there, the guards would close off the air vents and the men would eventually suffocate. Standing outside that building, the guide showed us a plaque on the wall of that building honoring a Polish Catholic priest that had been mounted to the wall of that building. He then told us the story behind it. He said there was only one time that more than a single person escaped from Auschwitz, a time when 3 people escaped together. The guards therefore selected 30 people, 10 for each escapee, and began herding them into the chamber of death. One of the 30 men, a local farmer, collapsed in tears and begged the guards not to kill him. A Polish Catholic priest who was still standing in formation was moved with compassion, and he walked up to the guards and asked if he could take the man's place. The guards freed the crying man, and the priest walked into the chamber of death and died. The farmer survived until the end of the war and was released from the camp. And after the war, he had the plaque made to honor the priest who had given his life so that he could live. The Polish Catholic priest loved his neighbor, even a stranger, more than himself. Brother Carl was with us that day at Auschwitz. He heard the story. And the next day at the convention, he was talking with a Polish elder and mentioned that some of us had visited Auschwitz the previous day. Brother Carl didn't mention the story about the plaque. The Polish elder volunteered to Carl. He said, "You know, there was one time when 3 of our Bible student brethren escaped from Auschwitz." Wow. It was that escape of 3 of our brethren that triggered the self-sacrificing act of that Polish Catholic priest and led to the plaque that we had seen. Do we have love like that? Do we love like Jesus? Talking to his disciples that last night, Jesus said, Greater love has no one than this, that he lay down his life for his friends. The Apostle John, in his first letter, writes a similar message, but focuses it on those we identify as our brethren. This is how we know what love is. Jesus Christ laid down his life for us, and we ought to lay down our lives for our brothers. And then a few lines down, let us not love with words or tongue, but with actions and in truth. 1 John 3:16 to 18. If we would think of a continuum of people and relationships, beginning with our natural family and continuing on down to total strangers and maybe even those we would identify as enemies, where on that continuum would we stop being willing to give our life to save the life of the other person if we had the opportunity? Do you think such a continuum was any part of Jesus' thinking in making his decision to give his life as a sacrifice? Or did he die to save everyone on the continuum, including even the scribes and Pharisees who harassed and tested him? We read in Romans 5, 6 through 8, you see, just at the right time when we were still powerless, Christ died for the ungodly. Very rarely will anyone die for a righteous man, though for a good man someone might possibly dare to die. But God demonstrates his own love for us in this. While we were still sinners, Christ died for us. For one will hardly die for a righteous man, though perhaps for a good man someone might even dare to die. The point Paul was making is very powerful. Jesus' love went beyond willingness to die for a righteous or good man. He willingly died for those who were sinners and enemies of God. Would we do this for our enemies or for those who might slander us or mistreat us? Jesus said in Luke 17:33, whoever tries to keep his life will lose it, and whoever loses his life will preserve it. You know, the labels we create and use to identify and categorize various groups of people also create different levels of caring for them in our minds. They can include racial and ethnic labels, or they can include labels such as homeless people, people who have committed crimes or criminals, welfare recipients, LGBTQ people, nominal Christians. The world has gone crazy with labeling and categorizing people, and these labels dehumanize people and invite less caring for them. As I consider Jesus hanging on the cross, I cannot imagine that labels for various categories of people was any part of his thinking. He was not dying for just some categories of people. He was not thinking that some categories deserved his grace more than others. He was dying to save all of them. And so are we, as we follow as his disciples. Recently, I watched the movie Hawaii, based on James Michener's book of the same title, and in it was a scene of the various Christian ministers who were located around the islands gathering for their annual business meeting, and one of the agenda items was a motion to expel one of their members from the ministry. What had he done? His wife had died, and he later married a Hawaiian woman. That was his offense. They voted to expel him from the ministry for marrying a Hawaiian woman. And they also voted to censure the other minister who had performed the marriage ceremony. As he got up to leave the room, the expelled minister turned to them and said, "You love Hawaiians as potential converts, but you despise them as people." Having come to the opposite conclusion, I gladly depart from a ministry in which love seems to have no place. There should be no room in the heart of any of Jesus' disciples to despise people for who they are or what they have done. God's plan is ransom and restitution for all of them. Yes, some people have done terrible things. Some of them have done those things personally to you and me. Some people are living lives that are very much at odds with God's counsel and His standards of righteousness. Yet Jesus said that there was none righteous, no, not one. And Paul tells us that those whom God has called to be His disciple, the disciples of His Son, are the lowliest of the low. We need not join with others in the world and in various Christian communities in labeling and denouncing these groups of people. Otherwise, we are in danger of marking a point on that continuum of people and relationships beyond which we are unwilling to love them more than ourselves, unwilling to die for them, to save them. Pastor Russell gives very good counsel on what is perhaps my favorite scripture passage. My favorite passage is Romans 12:18. If it is possible, as far as it depends on you, live at peace with everyone. And the pastor says in reprint 49:78, we are exhorted by the apostle to remember that what God sees fit to permit, we can see fit to endure. Even though we find many things which we cannot endorse, we may equally find ourselves able to avoid any special denunciation of them. Well, we are past time and a couple of minutes, and I said I would end on time, and I've already violated that. I'll close with just a quote, one quote that I heard recently. It was a statement by a Christian minister, and here's what he said. Here's what I have learned as a pastor. You can't lead the people unless you love the people. You can't love the people unless you know the people. And you can't know the people unless you walk among the people. And that is what Jesus did during His earthly journey. And that is what we are doing as we follow Him. May the Lord add His blessing.